Welcome back to Midpoint, friends. On this May 13th, 2026, I'm your host, Shelley Rebeck, with a very timely show for you today. With all of the news about the hantavirus on the Dutch cruise ship and the more than 100 norovirus victims on the Princess cruise ship out of Port Canaveral, I thought we ought to find out what health risks do you assume when you take a cruise, and how are you protected, and what is happening with the hantavirus victims. Today, I'm going to be speaking with the experts on the hantavirus and some other infectious diseases prevalent on cruise ships lately. What are the health risks? What are the public health responses? And what are the cruise line's legal responsibilities toward its passengers who do get sick? I'm very privileged to have with us a number of experts. My guest, Dr. Kartik Cherubudi, is the chief epidemiologist from Tampa General Hospital, and Dr. Sven Berman is the dean of the USF College of Public Health and an epidemiologist himself. Dr. Thomas Unash, now retired professor at the USF College of Public Health and a friend of the show, is back with us, and Jacob Munch, a board-certified maritime attorney, is here, and they are going to cover the waterfront, see what I did there, on all of these issues in just a moment after a brief review of some Florida news nuggets of the week. First, as you heard last week, three lawsuits brought on behalf of Florida voters were filed right after Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill approving the new congressional redistricting map. The plaintiffs, me among them, are claiming the new maps violate the Fair Districts Amendment voted into our state constitution by the voters of Florida in 2010, precluding any partisan gerrymanders based on redistricting to help one political party over another. These lawsuits also challenge the breaking up of districts that were created to finally allow black populations to have a chance to elect a black representative. And the plaintiffs also claim that the new maps were not based on equalizing representation by population counts as the U.S. Constitution requires. But now, surprise, surprise, a state of Florida official has told local election supervisors to hold on to their old maps, the ones used in 2022 and 2024 congressional elections, even as the election supervisors had begun the time-consuming and expensive task of adopting new districts created by DeSantis for the 2026 midterm elections. The advice did not cite the lawsuits as a reason, but it seemed to suggest that there was at least a chance that legal challenges could prevent the new map from being used for this year's midterm elections, whose primaries are scheduled as soon as August 18th. So keep your fingers crossed. Now, some good news from the Everglades last week. Florida appears to have plans to close the immigration concentration camp, Alligator Alley. Apparently, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has decided that the Florida-run immigration detention facility is just too expensive. The DeSantis administration has been spending more than $1 million a day of Florida taxpayers' money to run the center, and Florida has yet to receive the $608 million in federal reimbursement funds that it has requested to construct and run the center from the feds. According to the New York Times, vendors who supply the facility have been told that the approximately 1,400 detainees would be moved out, possibly to other federal detention facilities by the start of June, and the Everglades facilities would be broken down over the following weeks. This is really good news. The facility was accused of keeping detainees in inhumane and unsanitary conditions, and the sensitive lands where it was constructed were harmed. The environmental groups who sued over the construction have vowed to continue their lawsuit to restore and remediate the land even as the center closes. And finally, shopping is a bit more of a pleasure at Publix now that the Florida's favorite grocery store has changed its policy on open carry of weapons. Signs now posted at Publix stores in Florida read, "Publix kindly asks that only law enforcement carry firearms openly in our stores." You'll recall that a September court ruling made open carry the law in Florida. Publix then opted to allow customers to bring their guns that were visible into their stores, citing that legal decision. But other major grocery chains, including Walmart and Winn-Dixie, asked their customers not to bring guns, using their discretion under the law, which allows businesses to decide whether to restrict firearms on their private property. But now, after months of allowing customers to openly carry guns in its Florida stores, Publix appears to have changed its controversial policy. All right, let's turn to our topic of the day. The potential health risks of vacation cruises. When you get on your cruise ship for your special vacation, maybe you've saved up for a year to celebrate an anniversary in Cancun, or maybe the grandparents are taking the family to the Mediterranean, or maybe you're an adventurer who's excited to go bird watching on a landfill in Tierra del Fuego. Well, the last thing you expect on your vacation is to spend it in a quarantine hospital in landlocked Nebraska. And yet that is exactly what some American passengers on the Dutch cruise ship, the MV Hondius, are doing right now after their exposure to a deadly strain of hantavirus, which has killed at least three people so far. The ship, the MV Hondius, had been at sea for around 3 weeks when passengers began to fall ill. Yet, with an incubation period of typically somewhere of 1 to 8 weeks, pinpointing where the exposure to this virus may have occurred could prove difficult. Meanwhile, the Caribbean Princess was denied permission to dock in Nassau, Bahamas, because 102 of 3,116 passengers, along with 13 out of 1,131 crew members, reported falling ill with norovirus, a gastrointestinal illness characterized by persistent diarrhea and vomiting. In a review of previously published studies, researchers found 127 reports of norovirus outbreaks on cruise ships, with many linked to contaminated food, contaminated surfaces, and person-to-person spread. A more recent report from the U.S. also showed that norovirus can spread very rapidly from person to person on a cruise ship. As far as we know so far, this is the first hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship. But let's find out more from my guests. Dr. Kartik Cherubudi is with us. He's the chief of epidemiology at Tampa General Hospital. So welcome to WMNF, Dr. Cherubudi.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And Dr. Sven Vermund is the dean of the USF College of Public Health and also an epidemiologist. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we're glad to have back Dr. Tom Unish, also from the College of Public Health. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me again.
And to help us understand, what is a cruise ship's duties of care toward its own passengers? Jacob Munch, a Florida board-certified maritime and civil trial lawyer, is also with us. So thanks for joining us, Jake.
Thanks for having me, Shelley.
All right, let me start with the two epidemiologists around my table here. What should we know about the deadly hantavirus that spread on the Dutch cruise ship? Is it common on cruises like the norovirus, or was this a one-off situation?
We haven't heard of hantavirus on a cruise ship before, so this is unusual. The first thing that jumped to my mind is, could there be a rodent infestation on the cruise ship? And that didn't prove to be the case.
Because it's caused by rodent droppings, right?
Rodents.
But only one certain mouse, not like New York City subway rodents, right? It's a particular mouse.
There are a variety of rodents.
Oh, yeah.
They tend to be various mice and various rats. So there are a variety of rodents that harbor hantavirus. The first time we recognized it as a threat in the United States was in 1993 with the well-known Four Corners outbreak, Four Corners where the states of Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico meet. And there was a cluster of young men who died of a hantavirus pulmonary syndrome. They alerted us to the risks that we had even in our own country, particularly in the West. It's well known in both Chile and Argentina, and that this emerged probably from an environmental exposure in Argentina among bird watchers was not surprising.
Huh. Well, how is it spread? We're hearing that it's spread through close contact. Do we know how close? Do we know whether it's a respiratory-like virus like COVID or through touching contaminated surfaces like norovirus or from tainted water like Legionnaire's disease, which is another type of disease that's fairly common. Well, I don't know about common, but we see it on cruise ships because cleaning their water systems is very difficult. So what do we know about spread? Dr. Cherubuti?
I think what we know so far is the spread predominantly happens from inhaling rodent droppings or soil contaminated with urine or other secretions from the rodents. You can get it from touching surfaces that are contaminated with these droppings as well. The most common way that's described is going out to clean out a shed or a building that's been infestated with rodents, and now you want to clean it out. That's the most common way that's described. The location.
Isn't that what we heard about Gene Hackman's wife in New Mexico? That was a fairly famous incident of someone dying from exposure to the hantavirus, right?
Thank you for bringing that up. Betsy Arowana, Gene Hackman's wife, did pass away with hantavirus, and that's the most common way. It tends to be one person affected, often underdiagnosed. I think this got more attention and got a good diagnosis because of the status of the person. We think it's vastly underdiagnosed in individual cases. That's one predominant way it presents. The other one is the outbreak way, where there have been small outbreaks described throughout the South Americas, like Dr. Verman described in the U.S. It also happens in Asia and Europe, where you have a lot more cases with similar kinds of hantaviruses. They tend to affect the kidney and the blood vessels much more. The New World ones, the Americas, tend to affect the lungs. But these differences occur not just in how they're present, but how often people die with this. The Asia and Europe ones tend to kill less. The American ones tend to kill more, 30% fatality rate.
So that's interesting. So the American hantavirus outbreaks are more deadly than what we see in Europe?
That we know of. We have fewer cases here and it's less well studied. So the best we can see in these outbreak settings with a well-described one in the South Americas as well, or even with this current one, the case fatality is around that 30-40%.
Wow. Okay, so it's been confirmed that at least 7 people from the Hondia ship have been infected that we know of so far. And of course, a number of people are still being monitored, and so we don't know their status yet. But the World Health Organization says that hantavirus is spread only by, quote, close and prolonged contact with people who are symptomatic. I don't know what the symptoms are that they're watching for. Dr. Verman, tell us, what would they be looking for from these people that they're monitoring?
Unfortunately, hantavirus looks a lot like influenza, and influenza looks a lot like coronavirus, and coronavirus looks like a whole host of other respiratory pathogens. So the early symptoms are not very specific, and that is one of the problems with a disease like hantavirus, is that without ready diagnostics, which you wouldn't expect on a cruise ship, you may not recognize the syndrome. I think we would have perhaps missed this one and chalked it up to flu, except people died. And when you have 3 people dying on a cruise ship, that is unlikely to be any other respiratory disease such as coronavirus or influenza.
Coronavirus being COVID,
correct,
right, which is what people commonly understand it to be. Okay, so the scientists who studied, apparently there was a fairly major notable outbreak in Argentina in 2018. And the scientists who studied that outbreak and the scientists who came out yesterday in France all believe that it is spread by respiratory secretions, by airborne transmission, just like COVID. So how likely is a hantavirus epidemic like the COVID epidemic? How likely is it that we'll see this it turn into a major worldwide even because these passengers were dispersed around the world? How likely is it that we'll see a worldwide epidemic like we did with COVID?
It's not likely. The respiratory viruses have widely varying characteristics. Measles is a good example of a highly infectious respiratory virus. If people on the cruise ship, just for argument's sake, had never been vaccinated and somebody with measles came onto the cruise ship, it's plausible that 90% of the people on that cruise ship would have been infected. That's how infectious measles is. Influenza and coronavirus, COVID-19, come second in line. There are a number of other respiratory viruses, and hantavirus is kind of at the bottom of that list. It's not as infectious. It's not as easy to transmit person to person. That's why it's so rare and why this is such news.
So not to panic, huh? All right, well...
Can I add two more things to that?
Yes, of course.
So one of the things that also makes it less infectious is the duration of infectivity. It has a much shorter window that someone who is positive with it can transmit it to another person. That makes it less likely. COVID or measles, you have a longer period of infectivity, about 3 days to 5-7 days. This one tends to be much, much shorter. And that's one thing that prevents it from spreading onwards from person to person to person to person, the characteristic of what makes something an outbreak. The second thing is the virus seems to mutate less, is what we've seen so far. When compared to the original strains, there's not much that's different from this particular strain, whereas influenza and COVID, with their nature of how they spread and how they infect other animals, they tend to mutate a lot more.
Well, okay, but are we ready if there was a larger outbreak? Is a vaccine ready? Is a vaccine for this disease available? Are we sure about how long the exposure period is, or how long an incubation period for this disease is? The Argentine study said that exposure can be as long as maybe 40 days. Doesn't that make managing this kind of outbreak much more difficult? How ready are we? Anybody want to take that on? Okay, Dr. Unash, tell us.
Well, there's absolutely no vaccine for this.
There's no vaccine.
Or any of the other hantaviruses that are circulating around the world. These tend to be very rare infections in people, and they tend to be, as mentioned before, kind of accidental infections most of the time. So there hasn't ever been a real impetus to develop a vaccine or, you know, a real reason to have a vaccine for something that affects a few hundred people a year. The risks would probably highly outweigh the benefits for trying to do a mass vaccination for that sort of thing. That said, the treatment for this is mainly palliative care, just like in the early days of COVID.
Like flu, take care of it the way you take care of the flu?
Well, I think it's a lot, I'll let one of the EMDs respond, but I think
well,
it's a lot more.
What are the symptoms of someone who has hantavirus? What are they exhibiting? What are they feeling?
As Dr. Vermin pointed out, they feel like they're coming down with a really bad flu. It tends to move pretty quickly, in my understanding, from feeling well to feeling very, very ill fairly quickly. Unfortunately, the case fatality rate is somewhere, depending on the strain of the virus, somewhere between around 30 and 50% with the New World viruses, which is a lot higher than COVID ever was.
Wow. That's a lot higher than COVID?
Yeah, COVID was, I think, maxed out in the early stages of the infection at around 2%.
Oh,
so
wow.
You're looking more at a virus with a case fatality rate somewhat equivalent to, let's say, the Black Death in in the middle medieval age.
All right, well, we're trying to calm people down, not get them all nervous and agitated. but basically, so to treat hantavirus now, you're basically, what is it, starve a cold, feed a fever, or is it the opposite? I forget. But is that really what we're talking about?
Much more aggressive, I think, than that.
What would we do?
Hospitalization, intubation, those sorts of things, to try and, just like they did with people with early stages COVID, or with pulmonary effects and measles. This is something that's you're not going to get over just by taking chicken soup for a couple of days.
Really? You haven't tried my chicken soup, though, but they'll cure what ails you. All right, you are listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa, and we are talking with experts about the recent hantavirus outbreak on a Dutch cruise ship and about the health concerns of cruising generally. If you have some questions about that, give us a call at 813-239-9663, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885, and we'll try to get them answered. But forgive me if I don't take a lot of calls, because we have so many experts here with us, and I want to hear what they have to say. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking to them. All right, let's talk a little bit more about the public health response to the hantavirus outbreak. I've read that some of the passengers were allowed to disembark and to go on their merry way before anybody thought to isolate them. They went on planes, and maybe they took an Uber from the airport. One person went to Pitcairn Island, which is a totally isolated place in the South Pacific with a population of 50 people who could all be wiped out if that person spread the disease there. Somebody else traveled to San Francisco. Another person, who's very ill now, I understand, traveled to France. So did the crews do the right things? Did they follow the right protocols in waiting to contain the hantavirus? Is there anything that we could have done more or better? Who wants to take that?
The crew was taken completely by surprise. I doubt that anyone was even aware of hantavirus as a disease. The doctor, unfortunately, got ill. And a volunteer passenger who was also a physician sort of stepped in to help.
But he was a cardiologist, right?
So that's correct.
He probably had no idea what was going on with hantavirus.
I would expect not. So it really was the death of the passengers that was the trigger for intensive investigation, because it won't be uncommon for someone to get a cold or a virus-like illness on a vessel, because you do share eating quarters and perhaps living quarters with others. Think about a cruise ship as a congregate living quarters. An army barracks comes to mind. A college dormitory comes to mind. A long-term care facility for the elderly. These are areas where it's not uncommon to transmit respiratory diseases because of proximity of people living with one another. Now, before people get too alarmed, there are millions of passenger days spent on cruise ships. And when one thinks about all of the cruise ships and all of the passengers on that cruise ship, you would have to sort of compare their illness rate to if they didn't go on the cruise ship.
Okay.
And it's quite plausible that cruise ships are no more dangerous than any other living environment. And so I would hate for people to somehow think that cruise ships are in some ways uniquely dangerous. You did mention the norovirus outbreak.
Right.
And that is
like
probably
a
the
petri
number one.
Dish of,
that's right. That's probably the number one complicating factor. Norovirus does seem to be more common on cruise ships. It's not a very lethal virus. It's no fun because you get a nasty gastrointestinal disorder, but it's not particularly dangerous, and it's also not particularly common. It does occur on cruise ships, but most cruises don't have a norovirus outbreak.
And what would the transmission methodology be for the norovirus? Is that the tainted surface kind of thing?
Yeah, norovirus notoriously stay for a long time on surfaces and need very few viruses to infect someone. and the cleaning has to be rigorous and is not killed by regular cleaners. You have to use bleach-based products.
Bleach-based product. So maybe people on cruise ships should travel with like those bleach-based wipes or something, and just to protect themselves. I don't know.
It's a reasonable thing, but it needs everyone to do it. Right? If you're the only person following it, you're less likely to protect yourself, and just treat them a little bit similar to how we treat hospitals.
Yeah, I noticed that cruise ships have like sanitation stations everywhere with disinfectant stuff, and you know, when you enter a dining room or around, just all around, they have these sanitation stations, and I imagine that's the reason why they have them, right?
And yeah, the dynamics of the place make it really tough. You have other areas where a lot of congregation happens, like sport events or so on, but the time that you spend there and interacting with each other and with surfaces is lower. On a cruise ship, you're together whether you like it or not for that 5 days.
Right.
And so just all the factors add up to why does norovirus happen there. We see it sometimes in, there was an outbreak in the Olympics, for example, where all these athletes were in one small space for days. So that's really what drives it, the duration and the type of interaction.
But from a public health perspective, public health seems to rely on the public doing the right thing. It's not just you all, the doctors of our public health community, saying what needs to be done. If people don't accept the advice and the recommendations and the expertise, then, you know, we're not any better off. And we saw that with regard to the COVID epidemic, where people refused to wear masks. There were big fights over that. People didn't necessarily act in their best interests. Same thing with going on a cruise ship and bringing your bleach wipes or what have you. Unless everybody does it, it's not going to be very effective. So particularly with hantavirus, the public health response seems to be complicated because of this incubation period of up to 40 days to potentially present symptoms and know that that's what you're dealing with. And people most likely can contract it when they are exposed, as you said, in close contact to a person with symptoms. It's hard to ask people to quarantine for 40 days when they are asymptomatic, right? I mean, people have to buy in and cooperate to that kind of recommendation. As of yesterday, there were around 40 people being monitored and quarantined in the United States for hantavirus exposure. This includes the 18 Americans from the cruise ship who went to this Nebraska quarantine center. 15 of them apparently have no symptoms at all as of yesterday. And one person tested positive and is in some sort of a biocontainment unit. But at least 16 states are also actively monitoring residents connected to the hantavirus outbreak. Florida is not one of them, we should say, right? We should emphasize that to our listeners. Florida is not one of the states that has a hantavirus-exposed person in it, to our knowledge, right, so
that's
far. But let's talk about that. You know, how important is it for people to buy into the public health recommendations to contain a virus like this?
To be honest, we often have greater successes when society binds together and says, we are going to have a water treatment plant to protect the safety of the drinking water. We are going to have a wastewater treatment plant to reduce risk of human and animal waste going into the environment. We are going to mandate vaccination for all children. When we have these
sorts...
Yeah,
well, that's gone.
Well,
you know?
Well, not yet.
Not yet.
But we have a better success, I think, when we're able to do things on behalf of people with their support and their cooperation, but we're not asking them to do a lot. If we have activities in public health prevention that require people to actually change their behavior, we have a mixed report card. HIV prevention comes to mind. COVID-19 challenges come to mind. So we would be pleased, those of us in the field of public health, to have persons appreciate the value of preventive measures. As our grandmothers told us, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Well, right. But we did see kind of rebellion against the advice of the public health professionals in the case of COVID. We had people, you know, really fighting over the recommendations to wear masks, right?
Absolutely true. I think a lot of that had to do, though, with probably a lot of the poor communication and some of the early information that came out that was proven later on not to be accurate. And people just kind of lost faith in the pronouncements that were coming out from the authorities about what was going on. And therefore, they just stopped listening to us.
Well, you know, I've been, in preparing for this show, spending a lot of time on social media, seeing what people were talking about, looking for the questions that people might want to have answered. One of the surprising things to me was some people recommending ivermectin, to take ivermectin for hantavirus. Is that legit? I mean, that was one of the things we heard in connection with the early days of COVID, the promotion of ivermectin, the horse drug, to cure COVID. Yes? Dr. Unash?
I can comment on that as a former member of the Mectazan or ivermectin distribution program for global program for elimination of neglected tropical diseases. Ivermectin basically works by, you know, inhibiting the nervous system of the worms that it treats. Viruses don't have a nervous system.
Huh.
So what is the potential idea that ivermectin is actually going to have an effect on anything that doesn't have a nervous system is kind of beyond me.
Okay.
Still sort of.
So that's a no. That's a hard no on the ivermectin.
A very hard no.
Okay. And I've got a call here from Chris, who wants to know, could dead bodies spread the virus and the infection? What do you could dead body, if you come in contact with a hantavirus victim who's deceased, could that be an exposure that could cause you to get the disease?
Maybe I can answer it in a two-part way. Mm-hmm. When we think about when is the hantavirus most infectious, it's in that early, what we call the prodromal phase, when nonspecific symptoms and the fever is just starting. That's when people are the most infectious, and then it rapidly drops off after that. And what kills people is the later complication phase, sort of like you had with COVID. Days later, when they start, the lungs start getting infected with the New World pulmonary syndrome, or when the kidneys and blood vessels start getting affected with the older world viruses. So by the time someone dies from hantavirus, they're really not infectious at that time.
So that would be a no, right? Yeah.
That's a much easier way.
Okay. All right. I've got a couple messages here. One person who said that he was on a cruise and saw a very large rat on the boat. I mean, you know, boats seem to have rats. I mean, that old saying, the rats are leaving the sinking ship. I mean, boats seem to have rats. If people see them on their particular ship, should they be very concerned that this is a site for the exposure to hantavirus?
I would be concerned for many things. I mean, that generally speaks to the cruise line not doing things very well. That would be a big red flag for me in many ways, more than the hantavirus. But like Dr. Verman said, there are specific species and specific hantavirus combinations. Yes, I would get the rat taken care of and have a more thorough investigation done regardless, because that's a red flag for me. But not, in general, not every rat you see is going to, the risk is going to be low, but I would be concerned regardless. That's not something I would want on a cruise ship.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, it would be a concern. There's a lot of bad things that can come from having rats in a closed environment like that. All right, because this is midpoint, I've got to add in some politics to this topic. And in case you're wondering, in case you're keeping score, we need to remind our listeners that there's a deadly outbreak of an infectious disease, and we have no CDC director, no FDA commissioner, and no surgeon general in office in our federal administration right now. It's hard to believe that the federal administration is that prepared when the top jobs in the area of public health are not filled. Let's talk about monitoring, monitoring cruise ships. I want to add here that it's been reported by CBS News that all of the full-time employees in the CDC's vessel sanitation program are also now off the job, gutting the agency's ability to investigate outbreaks and conduct health inspections on cruise ships. Only a smaller group of 12 U.S. Public Health Service officers have remained. The cuts also included the one epidemiologist who led the CDC's outbreak response on cruise ships. These cuts were part of RFK Jr.'s restructuring plans, which wiped out the vessel sanitation program's ability to control and monitor illness outbreaks on cruise ships. Now, previously, the VSP conducted thorough inspections of vessels in the areas of food safety and environmental sanitation. And in addition to the inspections, the VSP conducted ongoing surveillance of these gastrointestinal illnesses, like norovirus, and they coordinated the outbreak investigations on vessels. And it also provided food safety and environmental sanitation training for cruise line personnel. And as we heard from Dr. Verman, the cruise personnel really had no idea of what was happening when the hantavirus outbreak occurred. These steep cuts to the vessel sanitation program really baffled CDC officials, because the small team staff is not even paid for by taxpayer dollars. It's the fees from cruise ship companies that pay for the program, which is supposed to inspect large vessels at least twice a year. These cuts saved no public money. But now three of the CDC's 20 port health stations have no staff at all, half have no officer in charge, and the remainder rely on just temp workers, leaving the country's first line of defense against incoming infectious disease severely weakened. And I should note that the MV Hondius is not under U.S. jurisdiction. It's a Dutch ship, so it wouldn't have been inspected by the CDC program, but it serves as a stark reminder of the risks that could reach the United States shores because of these cuts by the Trump administration. Dr. Verman, you mentioned before we went on air that most countries allowed the CDC to conduct inspections at their ports. It was like the international standard. Is that still the case, if you know?
I would phrase it a little differently. The CDC is very much on call for global assistance. They're not in the process of routine inspections of international sites, but if they're invited by an international entity to participate in an outbreak investigation, or even to prevent an outbreak, they have a global reach. And because we are a large country with a previously well-funded public health infrastructure, we have reached beyond our shores to assist other countries in disease control and prevention.
And is that, are they still available now that the vessel sanitation program has been gutted?
I'm not aware of specifics about that program, but they are less available. There's no question about that. Many CDC staff who were placed overseas have been brought back to the U.S.
Yeah.
And there are over 2,500 people at CDC who no longer work there.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have a lot of messages here, and rather than reading them all, let me just sum up by saying a lot of people are concerned about what is the cruise ship's responsibility to maintain the health of its passengers. So I want to turn to Jacob Munch now. Jake is a board-certified maritime and civil trial lawyer who, among all other things maritimey, sues cruise ships for people who have suffered various injuries on board. So, Jake, tell us, what is the standard of care for a cruise line toward its passengers, and what risks do passengers accept when they take a cruise?
Well, the first thing you'd have to do is is take a look at what country is going to govern the law, right? If the ship is touching and coming into a United States port, then U.S. federal maritime law is going to govern a claim made against that ship. However, here we have the Hondius, and I've checked that company. The company running it is Oceanwide Expeditions. So the first thing is you look at the ticket. When anybody goes on a cruise, there's about 20 to 30 pages of fine print. And you go down when you check and agree to the terms and conditions. For the Hondius, you have agreed that any claims made against Oceanwide Expeditions is going to have to be made in the District Court of Middelburg in the Netherlands. So that's where you're going to have to bring a claim. Now, if it were a Royal Caribbean, NCL, Norwegian Cruise Lines, Carnival, that touched the United States port, their forum selection clauses call for lawsuits to be made in the United States in the federal court in Miami, Florida. Okay. So the duty under U.S. law, which I handle all the time, is reasonable care under the circumstances. And in order to rest liability against the cruise line must have either actual notice or constructive notice of the risk-creating condition.
Okay.
So in other words, if say this was a ship subject to United States jurisdiction where it made a call in the United States and a claim could have been brought, you'd have to show that the cruise line had notice, either constructive or actual notice, of this hantavirus and how it is going to affect the passengers.
Now, how would you be able to show that?
It might be very difficult. However, the duties involve proper quarantining measures once they become aware of the danger.
Okay.
Preventative measures, and of course, screening measures too. So once they've determined that there is this hantavirus aboard, we're not living in a vacuum, they have communications with shoreside personnel, then the duty can shift because they're going to be talking to doctors and physicians once they've determined it is hantavirus. Before they know what it is, it's very difficult.
Well, before we go on with the duty of care, let me just turn back to the doctors for a second. Would the ship be able to diagnose hantavirus as opposed to something else? Would the ship's doctor even be able to know that they had hantavirus on board?
It's extremely unlikely. The diagnostics for hantavirus, most hospitals in the United States don't have it. You have to send the specimen over to the CDC to get tested. Even with the person who was airlifted out to South Africa, that wasn't their number one thing that they tested
that they
for.
They thought it was.
Yeah.
So somebody dies on the ship, and several people seem to exhibit some symptoms of what looks like the flu. They really wouldn't have necessarily known what they had on their hands, right? And so, Jake, under those circumstances, would there be some special duty on the ship to do some sort of containment, quarantine, sanitation, that type of thing?
I think the ship, in this situation, the ship's doctor got sick himself.
Right.
But that doesn't prevent the cruise line from getting help ashore from physicians and explaining what's going on. Mm. And those physicians are then going to start making decisions about how to quarantine and how to handle the situation. The absolute worst position to be, of course, we do nothing.
Right.
And we keep mixing people. But there have to be if I was going to be handling the case. I'd be looking to see what affirmative decisions were made at that point to investigate, quarantine, and prevent the risk of spreading to other passengers once it's determined that we've got some sort of infectious or contagious disease aboard. It is, what do they do? What was the standard is, under U.S. law now, what is reasonable care under the circumstances? What do the circumstances dictate? And what was their reaction to that? Was that reasonable or unreasonable?
Now, and I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but given the limited facts that we know to date, if this was your case, if you represented the family of the person who died on this ship from hantavirus, and if this was a ship that called on American ports or an American ship, would you see a case here for wrongful death, for negligence?
First of all, I don't know all the facts.
Right.
And I'd be looking to see what they did once they determined they had an actual disease that is spreading amongst its passengers and maybe crew. I haven't heard a lot about
the crew member
exposure.
There were some crew members also exposed.
And the crew, of course, the ship owners under U.S. law have a very, very different duty, a much higher duty of care with respect to crew members under an American law known as the Jones Act.
Uh-huh.
So it's a much different standard. But to get back to your question, if the family had come to me, I'd start investigating what was their reaction when this happened. What did they do? And I don't think it's necessarily having to prove it's hantavirus and say we just throw our hands up because it's something we don't know about. People deal with infectious diseases. Cruise lines have been held responsible for Corona 19, Legionnaires' disease. It's all about notice. What did they know and what was their reaction?
And is an illness on a cruise treated any differently in law from, say, tripping on a life preserver and breaking a hip, which is an easier sort of causation kind of thing?
Causation can be difficult, but if we're isolated amongst the ship itself, then the causation becomes less difficult. With COVID-19, with people going ashore, you could get COVID-19 anywhere.
Yeah.
Right? So the causation is much, much different. Hantavirus seems to be very, very specific.
Well, and if this first guy who died of hantavirus really caught it while bird watching on a landfill by himself, when he wasn't even on one of the cruise ship's excursions, how can the cruise line be held responsible?
That'd be a very difficult case.
Yeah.
Right?
That'd be a very difficult
case. Yeah, of course.
Can we ever know whether he got it from bird watching on the landfill or some other situation? We may never know that.
So the real point is, what about the next time? Are we going to have another bird watching excursion at the landfill? And if they get sick that time, there's a duty to warn passengers about known dangers. Now we know at this landfill, potentially, hantavirus exists. But then again, it's a causation. Was it the landfill? Was it a rat or mouse from somewhere else?
Right.
But that the second person is always obviously the better case.
It's the better case, right. So what about medical personnel on cruise ships? Are they required to be actual MDs, actual doctors? Or what about ships registered in other countries? In the case of the Hondius, apparently, as we've said, the ship's doctor became infected and ill, and some random cardiologist on board had to take over the medical care of the passengers. What kind of medical facility do they have to have on the ship?
Cruise ships in the United States, you go on Carnival, Royal Caribbean, Norwegian, they all fly what's known as flags of convenience. In other words, they fly a Bahamian flag, a flag of the Azore Islands, so they don't have to hire U.S. seamen and seafarers and pay U.S. wages.
Okay, well, what about the medical personnel?
So the medical personnel can be, they're medical doctors licensed in whatever country. It could be Italy. It could be any country. South Africa, I've seen them. And they generally have in their fine print that the cruise line is not responsible for the medical staff, that they are 1099 employees, and they're not actual people that work for the cruise line.
Right.
Independent contractor.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but there are ways under U.S. if the ship calls in a U.S. port, under agency theories to get around that fine print and be able to hold the cruise line responsible for the negligence of the cruise ship doctor.
Oh, okay.
If they were negligent, of course.
If they were. All right, so the ship was not allowed to dock into port in some places, even though the passengers were sick and some needed to be hospitalized. Is that allowed? Can a ship legally be denied entry into a country where passengers need medical care that can't be provided on the ship? In these circumstances?
So I'm not an expert in port security. However, I think a government could take reasonable steps to assure the safety of the people. I would think they'd be able to talk with experts sitting around this table and see what are the risks and what should be done.
But are they allowed to prevent the ship from coming into port?
I think the ship was allowed to come into port. They just weren't allowed to dock and disembark their passengers.
Okay, well, that's what I mean. Were they allowed to prevent the passengers from getting on?
I think yes, until there's a reasonable assessment to the threat.
Okay.
The doctors are nodding their heads, so I think I hit the nail on the head there.
All the doctors around the table agree with that. Okay, so if you're on a ship and there's a black plague on the vessel, you might not be allowed to get off the ship for treatment, right? Yeah?
I think you have to weigh that risk and benefit, right? Are you going to be taking care of the patients on board and taking care of them? Are you protecting the people they might expose to and cause a much bigger public health problem?
Right.
I think that's what you weigh.
Okay. All right. That's really pretty much all we have time for today, my friends. This has been a fascinating show. Is there anything that anybody wants to add at the very end? We have like just one minute, very briefly. Any of our public health people want to disabuse people from refraining from getting on cruise ships? Or
I'll just say that sometimes there are unfortunate exposures from Mother Nature. And yeah. It's not anybody's fault.
Right. And sometimes it is somebody's fault, and that's when Jake comes into play, right? Okay. All right. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Kartik Cherubudi, Chief of Epidemiology at Tampa General Hospital, Dr. Sven Verman, the Dean of USF's College of Public Health, Dr. Tom Unosh, who's a retired professor from USF's College of Public Health, and Jacob Munch, our maritime attorney and law of the sea expert. Thanks to all of you for sharing your expertise on this really valuable show. I apologize to the listeners. We didn't have a whole lot of time for phone calls, because we had so much information to cover. I want to thank also our WMNF volunteers, our soundboard operator, Jessica Green, and our show assistant, Daria Miranova. Remember, you can listen to Midpoint on demand from our archives at wmnf.org/midpoint, on the WMNF app, or as a WMNF Midpoint podcast on most podcast platforms. Talking Animals is up next after the NPR News, followed by The Conversation with Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. So stick with us on WMNF Tampa. Our fundraiser is coming up on June 3rd, and we here at Midpoint will be anxiously awaiting your participation in our membership drive and our summer fundraiser, because as you know, we are totally supported by your generosity, and we are very, very grateful for it. We get no government assistance anymore. So stick with us on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next week. We gotta fight the problems that be.